Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Greetings and welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today's special guest is Amitav Bihar, Executive Director of Oxfam International. Amitav is a global civil society leader with decades experience in human rights, philanthropy, democracy, social justice, and building citizen participation. Prior to this role, he was Chief Executive Officer of Oxfam India. Mr. Bihar was the Vice Chair of the Board of Civicus. He also serves on several boards, including the Global Fund for Community Foundation and the Norwegian Human Rights Fund. Prior to Oxfam, Mr. Bihar was the Executive Director of National Foundation for India and served as a co-chair of Global Call to Action Against Poverty, a network of over 11,000 civil society organizations. It's good to meet you. Just for everybody's awareness, I've not met Amitav before. It's our first meeting. So delighted to have you here on this podcast. Can we begin, Amitav, by just setting out where we are today? We live in a precarious and an interdependent world. The precarity is going to get greater with climate change, with technological disruptions. We're going to be facing polycrisis for the foreseeable future. We've had a crisis in the last period due to US aid being shut down. Many people critiqued the aid system before that, and this is like an amplification, some people say, of what was already happening, that there was problems, that there was trouble, and then suddenly we've got this huge amplification. Can you reflect on kind of where we are today? Just give us some context where you think we are at the moment.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon. Really happy to have this conversation with you. So you started out with a very, very macro picture, talking about the polycrisis and then moving on to the very immediate. So let me try and respond to both. The way I see it is that we are probably reaching now a moment where the polycrisis, which at least according to me, is not really a polycrisis. It's one crisis with multiple manifestations. And that is the new neoliberal economic system that we have created, which leads to climate crisis, which leads to inequality, which leads to hunger. That has reached a level of now pretty much shedding all pretense of being humane, being democratic, trying to still work within a liberal framework. So what you're essentially seeing is almost an announcement by the forces that this is complete victory, and we are now not going to have even concessions for an alternative worldview. So that's how deep I think the crisis is, because this is probably the biggest crisis post World War II in terms of rule of law, in terms of core liberal values. So so that's where we are, and we want to stay with the crisis at the moment to comprehend it better. So I don't want to move ahead, but coming to the other question on what we have seen in terms of the executive orders coming from the US, it is in many ways, again, a manifestation of the complete rupture in the fundamental normative consensus that still governed international relations it still governed the broad developmental world. That's how I look at it.
Yeah.
And I do have sympathies, just to end with, you know, kind of the critique of say the USAID resources, etc. I do have sympathies with a lot of that criticism, but this is not about challenging that criticism, the critique. This is coming from a different space. So this is really coming from a way more aggressive space than really trying to make the US aid system work. That's how I look at it, yeah.
Yeah, well, you've summarized it in quite stark terms, you know, and I wouldn't argue with you. I think you're absolutely right. The veil has been taken off neoliberalism, and it's there's no kind of hiding place now. Before the Trump administration, the liberal order, the international liberal order, people like Nancy Fraser, the theorist, she was arguing that there was like progressive neoliberalism, that they were, the progressive forces were actually still a cover for this neoliberal movement, really. You know, they tried to alleviate some of the worst suffering, but really they were just part of it, and it was all about economic growth and still pursuing that thing. Is that your opinion?
Yeah, that's what you know. Just to say that whatever we look at, they're always going to be outliers. Mm-hmm. So in society and polity, you do not have just one picture, because I really feel I've seen many of those friends who have worked really hard, all of us, over the last few decades on still doing progressive politics within the neoliberal framework. So to summarily dismiss that effort would not be all right.
Correct.
However, from an academic zoomed out lens, I would agree with what you're saying, that in essence, this has been the progression, that the power consolidation of power has now been so complete with a billionaire president backed by the richest man in the world, that they do not need to now have the garb of progressive politics. So that's how I look at it. But just to say that on the other hand, that's the beauty of a liberal framework, that there are spaces, those spaces are now getting shut down. There are spaces for challenging that consolidation of power. So, you know, the big question for us is, that can we stay with really this problem that we have identified and find ways of challenging it, instead of finding now ways of how we tweak our existence to live with it. So that's how I would look at it.
Yeah. I mean, one thing struck me was, apart from the viciousness of kind of what's happened, is the... it is very radical, like although it's happening slowly, it is very radical, and it made me think about how unradical a democratic left has been, or the left has been, how shy the left has been, or progressive forces that have been, to kind of challenge the hegemony of neoliberalism, and now we're just seeing a real radicalism, but from a very dangerous place.
You know, I would kind of challenge even your formulation, and tell you if you agree with it or not. Where is the left? As in the world that you're talking of, as in, yes, left in probably in Latin America in parts, but after you got your new left in the UK, is that really the left that you're talking of, which has the spine and the theoretical understanding to challenge the neoliberal framework? I really doubt that. So sure. I would actually say that we have already moved the whole spectrum so much towards the center and to the right, that even the center today seems like the left. And I would say that's a fundamental problem, that the center will not be able to challenge the radicalism of the right, the fundamentalism of the right. It has to come from a more rooted ideological response, and that's not what we see. So the the diminishing left ideas have contributed to where we are. So I would say that the hegemony is so complete at this moment that you just need to work within it. As in, we need to challenge our work, all of us in the INGO world. How much are we part of ultimately the neoliberal system? Are we being able to radically question the fundamentals of neoliberalism? So we need to ask real tough questions of ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think I was agreeing with you. I think you said it much more articulately than I did. But I think, yeah, I was saying that, you know, that any left radicalism has been kind of brought into the center, into the right, and has lost its way, and has done for many years, in fact. Where does it leave an internationalist idealism, a humanitarian idealism? Where do we go from here?
That's a tough one, and that's a tough one because of particularly the onslaught that one faces on a daily basis, and that's probably therefore the moment for us to take a pause, relook at where our strengths are, where our energy is, and I do feel that it's not going to come from pragmatism. It will come from idealism. And therefore, it is about rebuilding the ideal again. There's a lot of work. So, you know, I've been, all my life, I've essentially done advocacy. That's been my core area of work. But I often now feel that we just went a bit too far in civil society with the idea of advocacy. Mm-hmm. Instead of spending time in the good old organizing and mobilizing, we thought that we will solve the problems. I'll get an interview in the BBC and an access to the World Bank president, and I can get it sorted. That's not how the world functions. Yeah. It is about going back to people's power. It is about understanding who's getting marginalized and excluded because of this economic system. And that's the majority of the people. It is about working with them, building new organizations. It is collectivization. So it's a lot of work in building that democratic response brick by brick. The only thing I would add is that it's going to be easier than what it would have been, say, 100 years ago, because of the new technology, etc. And I'm hopeful because I already see the people's power that you see already erupting in different spaces. It is, again, I think, our failing of the organized civil society that once the eruption happens, we are not there to support and sustain that change process. And what you see is a change of regime, which actually brings in probably even a more fundamentalist regime. So how do we engage with that people's power? And that looks like, for me, the long haul for us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's similar to a critique. I mean, the Ecolutionary Institute, we publish, and we're a think tank, and we I mean, the work I'm doing is really to draw on social movements as an inspiration, to draw on activism as an inspiration, to think about, we talk a lot about leadership from the edge. We talk about a kind of ecosystemic perspective, because the traditional left has actually been quite a centric, top-down force. And I think that this has become part of the problem, that it's become quite static and not adaptive enough. But as you say, you know, with new technologies, with kind of the ecosystem around us, we see activism, we see movement, we see some energy. And that's kind of where I see the possibility of change taking place at the edges. And as we know, change can take place very quickly. It can change to the right very quickly, but also it can change again very quickly. So I think there is some hope there.
I agree. As in, we are in the business of hope. As in, I wake up every morning feeling that there are possibilities of change. And we need to work with that. And there's solid evidence for it. As you said, it's happening on the edges. there are going to be big questions that we'll certainly need to answer. And that's again part of, say, the left critique of the civil society movement, so to speak. I'm using it in loosely, the grassroots movements, the new social movements, that they do not have the ability to come together and make systemic change. Mm-hmm. I think that critique is going to be critical now when you see enormous consolidation of power and wealth in fewer and fewer hands, and technology mm-hmm. also. So it's knowledge, data, wealth, and political power. So in that context, we need to think of how do you challenge something as mega as this. But I agree with you that the answers are going to come from the edges. It's the people. Change does happen fairly quickly. And there's lots of evidence around us.
Yeah.
And maybe just on a positive note, just a couple of weeks ago, I was at the World Economic Forum, and we were having a conversation on gender, and we were reminded, somebody talked about it, that sitting in Switzerland, women didn't have even voting rights till the early 70s. No. So we have also, if you really zoom out, I think we've also made huge progress. Mm. And we will continue on that trajectory.
Yeah, and there has been huge gains in different areas. And also, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind, it can sometimes seem like the right has won everything, but, you know, even in America, there's a 50-50 split in the country. It's not a 90-10 split. It's a, you know, and a lot of the supporters of the right are working class, disillusioned supporters who feel let down by a system and can turn again very quickly, because, you know, I think they're going to get let down again very, very quickly by these oligarchs who are taking power to themselves, and they will see that it's not going to support the kind of the workers' rights as they hoped.
Yeah, no, I agree. And absolutely, that's precisely. What is interesting is that the constituency of these populist, right-wing, authoritarian leaders should be the natural constituency of the left.
Right.
And therefore, you know, what I was saying earlier, how do you engage much more in organizing, mobilizing, working with communities, and not trying to engage with power and changing power through your persuasive lobbying skills. So it is those constituencies will get disillusioned. How do you build their power to challenge these oligarchs? That's really the question for all of us. That's a big question, and I do think that we need more thinking. And yeah. You know, kind of get out of, Simon, I would very strongly say in this conversation, the space that we are doing this conversation, how do organizations like even an Oxfam get out of focusing on the organizational sustenance, stability, future, vis-a-vis the historic role that needs to be played?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I 100% agree. I mean, I talk about organizations being ecosystems within ecosystems, and we have to think about these wider ecosystems, the political, the social, the technological, the environmental, and how each organization kind of plays its part in those kind of wider ecosystems and drive the social change and the social justice we want. One thing is, I'm a bit stuck with is, you know, if you follow humanitarianism, it followed a path of the Enlightenment of kind of progressive ideas of caring for the distant other, and it became a kind of colonial salvation aid alongside doing some really good work. These two things sort of went in parallel, and sometimes it slips too much into the colonial salvation aid. And what, as you say, you know, there's some super amazing work has been done, and amazing things have been achieved. You know, how do you think we can reposition aid and an international order? I'm I'm troubled by, like, how do we get to an international order? Because we need to learn to collaborate together to answer the big environmental questions, to answer some of the big political questions. We need this international collaboration, and yet the existing order didn't deliver and faltered. Have you got any thoughts on that, Amitav?
Yeah, so it's a tough one, Simon, because we have answers, and that's what we've been discussing more at the meta level.
Yeah.
But when it gets to operationalizing a lot of this, then the realities of organizational rigidities, resources coming ultimately from the same regimes, which in many ways perpetuate the inequalities that we are talking of, or the injustices that we are talking of. So it is a tough one. And therefore, it is at some level reconceptualizing the role of civil society. And, you know, and if you could just give me half a minute, I would say that they've said the broad four roles of civil society. One, charity. That's what you kind of talked of. The second, development. The third, watchdog. And the fourth is building alternatives. I think we have swung a bit too much to the first and second. And therefore, the watchdog role, that ultimately in a democracy, the architecture of democracy, the civil society is to hold power to account when even institutions like the parliament and the media, etc., are not able to do so. That's how I look at it. Mm-hmm. And that's a function we are not playing. And certainly we are not playing enough of the fourth, which is to build alternatives from our grassroots practice, working with communities. There are alternatives, and we have built alternatives early, as in the whole feminist movement does come from broadly those building alternatives. The green movement comes from building those alternatives. So how do we start rechannelizing our energies into the third and fourth role? And this is in no way to say that the first and second are not important. I would have probably said that 25 years ago. I've seen how important it is to do those. But I think at the moment, in terms of the moment of history, it's the third and the fourth role that we'll need to work on. So, you know, maybe we'll get some answers, but it's going to be a tough journey for us, because we have also, ultimately, the aid industry, we are part of it. We have created our own livelihoods, our own ways of working, our own empires, so to speak. So it's a tough one.
Yeah. This is so interesting for me. I've been working with Save the Children, and we've been running some very interesting experiential events where we work with Ukrainian NGOs alongside people in the troubles from Northern Ireland, NGOs, and bringing people from different experiences together and doing experiential events with the heading like rebuilding civil society. Like, what does this mean? And asking those questions and allowing people to really work through some difficult challenges, you know, like not giving them easy structures or lectures or seminars. Just say, you're gifted people, you're talented people. What do you do in this space together? And they struggle, but it's so interesting to see what emerges, and the powerful relationships which emerge, the powerful learning from each other, the sharing of wisdom, the sharing of experiences. And it is, I think, from those, it's almost like a new consciousness raising awareness that I think we need to do, back to sort of civil rights, back to kind of feminists, back to these movements. I think consciousness raising is a vital part of this. And this means creating spaces for this to take place.
Yeah, no, I agree. As in, these are the experiments which can give us some answers. So when I started working, one of the first books given to me was Paulo Freire. So with the pedagogy of the oppressed, we need to go back to a lot of that work. There is work around us. So how do we more quickly learn from each other? Like the initiative that you talk of, I can, you know, hear you in terms of the dilemmas and the difficulties that group would have had. But what would have come out from it would have been a very solid, at least pathway with which one could experiment with. So I do feel that there is practice around us. We need to bring that practice together, but we need to be focused on staying with the problem. That's the point. As in this conversation, I love it, because the problem is not the trouble that we're talking of is not that my budget size is going to dramatically get reduced because USAID is not going to support us. The problem is that the fundamental normative framework of solidarity, of human dignity, of human rights is crumbling. So it's also how you frame where you need to stay.
Yeah. And there's new generations as well who are both advanced in these ways of thinking, and some have no experience of them. So those of us who can turn to Freire and turn to Gramsci and turn, we have resources that are around us, but some people have not experienced it. And I think it is, I mean, when I talk about ecosystems as well, I talk about the hidden resources within those ecosystems, and it's hidden talent, hidden potential, hidden leadership, hidden material resources. We often kind of just look up and down, and we can get into binaries where we blame the global north or blame the kind of the big institutions. But the ecosystems we live in and experience our lives in, they're filled with resources if we can harness those resources. And I think cross-generational work is going to be a big part of this, I think. In a moment, there's quite often generational divides.
I would be happy to hear you're framing the question in that sense, or probably you experience it. I have a slightly different take. And my take is that across generations, and you brought in Gramsci, so let me just go back to him. The hegemony is so complete at the moment that it is not a generational thing. So even the ones who have, I know India reasonably well. Nobody can know India well enough, but I know it reasonably well. And in India, even the ones who were part of the radical left movement are now buying into a majoritarian politics and a neoliberal economics. In the whole idea is the relationship between the state and the citizen has so completely changed, where the citizen is in the service of the state and it's not the other way around. So in this, I don't see a generational divide. It is a normative divide, and how those norms get created, ultimately going back to hegemony. So art, literature, cinema, political rhetoric, serious politics, all that is caught within the neoliberal frame. So that's how I would look at it. While I completely agree with you, the first part, that therefore, how do you engage with the younger generation, which is getting into activism, which comes in with enormous energy? How do you share the tools that you talked of? That's certainly there. But I find it slightly deeper than just seeing it as a generational divide. Yeah. Sorry for being more pessimistic, but tell me if you think it's generational in maybe say UK and
I think it's both, and I totally agree with you about the hegemony and people are completely caught up in ways of thinking which don't allow them to think outside of that perspective. So we're all consumers now. We're all we're stuck in those bubbles, and that's very difficult. But I do also see. Particularly in Europe and in Ireland, but there's a definite generation. Like when we were in Northern Ireland, it was interesting. The people from Ukraine we brought over, they were often young women because the men are fighting the war, and the young women are taking over running NGOs. Absolutely inspirational sort of people from 19 to sort of their 35 kind of age group, and the older age group in Northern Ireland who'd seen the troubles, I actually found it quite difficult to communicate with them initially. It took quite a long time. There was a real generation. You could actually feel it's generational. It wasn't just about kind of being from Ukraine and Ireland. It was a generational conversations. And then when they broke through that, there was immense learning and kind of a joy in the learning between these groups. You know, people who've gone through a trauma, people who are going through a trauma, and the sharing. So I think there is, you know, work within generational. And there's other divides, there's many divides, you know, there's technological divides, there's all sorts of divides. And I think bridging these divides is going to be part of the work.
Sure. Yeah. No, I appreciate that, particularly if, say, for instance, when you're talking of Ireland, the generation which has experienced the conflict firsthand and then the peace building. So, yeah, so that would be a different story. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Amitav, we're coming towards an end. Have you got anything else you'd like to share with the? We're going to put this podcast out to a wider audience. Have you got any thoughts which, I mean, are on your mind at the moment in particular?
So, all these conversations are really important for us. So thank you for doing it. I think and I hope people like us not only intellectually comprehend the gravity of what we are going through, but also emotionally respond to it. I think that's critical. A lot of these conversations are just at the head level. It's an intellectual conversation. So blending of the heart and mind is going to be really central moving ahead. So, you know, this whole emphasis from our side, again, many of us, let's do fact-based advocacy, etc., which is great, but it's about narratives. So it is about reaching people. And that's what we need to move towards and go back to a more comprehensive look at human dignity, rights. It's not about those specific, you know, I work on livelihoods in a specific area, etc. It's a larger piece. But let me just end. I'm also convinced, as in the more I travel, the more people I meet, there are million mutinies happening at the moment, and there's enormous quest for freedom, justice, and human dignity amongst people around the world. So that will eventually win. That, yeah. I'm sure. Let's put all our energies in helping that battle.
I totally agree. It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you for your thoughts, Amitav.
Thank you.